We'll take the first case this morning, which is 20-7021, Meek v. Martin. Counsel for appellant, if you would make your appearance and proceed, please.
James Hankins for Petitioner Meek. May it please the court. Do you want me to go ahead and start, Your Honor?
You bet.
This is a first-degree murder case out of rural southeastern Oklahoma. It has kind of a unique feature that the state was unable to produce the corpus, the body of the alleged murder victim, which was the wife, Hope Meek, which is the wife of the petitioner. Now, this occurred. Miss Meek went missing back in 2002. However, over a decade went by before Jerry Meek, the petitioner, was charged, went to trial, and was convicted of first-degree murder of her death in 2013. Now, Judge Kelly of this court granted a certificate of appealability on three issues: sufficiency of the evidence, some ineffective assistance of counsel allegations, and cumulative error.
Mr. Now, if you'll allow me, if I can just jump in on the ineffective assistance of counsel arguments. And specifically, I want to focus for a moment on the one related to the alleged hearsay statements. And as it relates to that one, the OCCA's opinion and the district court as well, it's my recollection, concluded that the defense counsel, trial counsel, was one reason that he was not ineffective in representation is that it was deemed to be a strategic decision to allow these statements to be entered into evidence. In other words, counsel let it happen. I know that you push back vigorously on that in your brief, but my question to you is this: is that determination by the OCCA that it is a strategic decision, is that a determination of fact?
In our view, it is not. In order to be a determination of fact, it has to be based on facts. And our view of the record would indicate there's no rational basis for the lower court to conclude that trial counsel made a strategic decision.
Let me stop you for a second. That's criticizing the merits of the determination. I'm categorically asking you whether that is whether that decision is one of a factual nature, and I believe it is, and unless you have some authority to suggest to the contrary, we can talk about whether it was an erroneous factual determination. We can go to that right now, but I want to get your view first on whether it in fact categorically is a factual determination.
I understand what the court is saying. The answer is yes, I believe that the state of the law is it is a factual determination with which we disagree.
Okay, well, under AEDPA, you have to do a lot more than disagree, don't you, in order to have that not be operative. Okay, well, then there has to be clear and convincing evidence in your pushback, because this is a D1 case, not a D2 case. So what's your basis for, number one, believing it's clear under, well, did you make an argument in your brief, is a better word, for an argument in your brief that it was not, shouldn't be accepted because it was clearly, because it was wrong under clear and convincing evidence standard?
I believe that was briefed, Your Honor, yes.
Okay. I don't recall that, but I'll go back and check on that. But beyond that, since it is a factual determination, let's assume for the moment, assuming for the moment that cannot be defeated under the clear and convincing evidence standard, why is it unreasonable for that strategic decision to be made? In other words, we've got double layer of deference here. Why would the OCCA be unreasonable, concluding that counsel was reasonable in acting in this strategic way?
Because of the nature of the hearsay evidence that was allowed. It's witness after witness recounting statements and claims made by Hope Meek, the alleged decedent, painting Jerry Meek as a spousal abuser and an otherwise, you know, unfit husband. There is no rational trial strategy where a defense lawyer would sit there and just let it come in without objecting. And well, it's the same with the other two.
Let me pause it, Juan, and then you tell me why it's irrational. I mean, one of the lines of testimony that went on in this case was that Hope Meek would never leave her children. I mean, that was a very powerful statement that kept being made repeatedly, that she would never leave her children. Well, doesn't there need to be a compelling narrative that would explain why she would leave her children? I know there was contrary evidence that she was a bad mother, but construing the facts in the light most favorable to the verdict and to the prosecution, the rational jury would have in front of it that she would never leave her children. Well, one reason she would feel compelled, even under these circumstances, to leave her children was that she was being abused and that Mr. Meek was a philanderer. I mean, why isn't that theory? You wouldn't have done it, maybe, but why is it unreasonable for counsel to choose to allow that to play out?
Well, in order to say it's unreasonable, you have to first assume it's true that trial counsel actually thought that, and that was the strategy. That's our objection, Your Honor, is any judge, any lawyer can look at the facts of any case and imagine some trial strategy that counsel may have entertained. But there has to be some evidence that trial counsel actually did that. And well, there is zero evidence in this case.
That's why I started with whether it was a factual determination. Because if, when I go back to the brief, my memory is confirmed that you didn't make a fulsome, clear argument that rebutted under the terms of AEDPA, did not rebut that factual determination, then we're stuck with it. Then the OCCA has said that that is a strategic call and we're stuck with it. Then the question just becomes, was the OCCA unreasonable in saying that he was reasonable? So unless the brief shows that you made an argument that was, you know, under a clear and convincing evidence standard, that we shouldn't accept that factual determination, we're stuck with it, aren't we?
Yes, with the caveat that if you're stuck with it unless the trial evidence shows it was an unreasonable characterization of the factual record. And that's what we are asserting that it was.
Yeah, but you didn't make a D2 argument, did you? This is a D1 case. There's no unreasonable application of the facts argument going on here. Is there? 2254 D2?
Well, we're
making any argument along that line.
Well, we contest the conclusion of the Court of Criminal Appeals.
The conclusion, no. I mean, you can make a D1 argument that is unreasonable, contrary to unreasonable application of Strickland. But that's different than making the D2 argument, as you know, your practice in this area, the D2 argument, unreasonable facts. All I'm saying is, okay, fine. I don't want to take up all your time on this, but if we are stuck with that determination by the OCCA that it was strategic, you accept the notion then that we have to evaluate whether that would be a reasonable strategic decision to make.
Correct, Your Honor. And you know, I understand that that's a high burden. And it's the same with the sufficiency of the evidence argument. That's a high mountain to climb for a petitioner. So if I could segue into another aspect of the IAC, this is the invocation of right to counsel during this police interrogation. Now, that issue actually takes us outside of the AEDPA. The district court, federal district court below, concluded this was de novo review. The state agrees with that.
Well, I want to get to whether the state actually agrees with that, but it's not clear to me at all that the OCCA did not review that issue on the merits. I mean, if it's one thing to say, when you look at, and I'm looking right now at the language that the OCCA issued in its response to the petition for rehearing. And in that, it said, I considered that. You haven't cited any authority on this whole dimension of invocation of right to counsel. You haven't cited any authority in this petition for rehearing that wasn't in your direct appeal brief. We considered that. We deemed it to be meritless. The subtext of that would be that if it was a meritless issue, then it was not unreasonable for counsel to object to it. So it's not clear to me at all that the district court was right here. Why doesn't that order tell us that the OCCA actually considered this issue?
Because they said that they were not going to reconsider their original opinion. And when you go back to their original opinion, they didn't render a decision on the merits.
Why couldn't their response in the petition for to the petition for rehearing indicate to us that they said, I did consider it? That's what I thought. How do you read that language? I mean, that language to me indicates you're raising this issue. This is something I've seen before, been there, done that. I've seen those authorities. I considered this. We found it to be meritless. That's what I read that to say. Why is that an erroneous reading of that order?
Well, I read it differently, Your Honor. I read it to say that on the petition for rehearing, the Court of Criminal Appeals is saying, you've already raised this. We've already considered it. We're not going to revisit it.
Okay. If they've already considered it, that means they've already under AEDPA, aren't we supposed to essentially presume that the court can, when the court issues a summary order, denied, the Supreme Court has told us that we're supposed to presume that they reviewed the merits. Well, in this situation, when they dealt with that issue, and in this petition for rehearing, in response to that, they say, we've been there, we've done that. We ruled on this issue. Well, and you didn't cite any different authorities, which means that they saw your authorities about invocation of the right to counsel. Why isn't that a merits? Why aren't they telling us that they made a merits determination?
Because the court did not say that we reviewed it the first time. What they're saying is we didn't offer anything new in a petition for rehearing that would cause them to go back and consider it again. And I know we can parse this language and.
Yes, I don't want to take up your time. I understand your position. Go ahead.
It is troubling, and whether this, the invocation of counsel, and Jerry Meek, this was a voluntary encounter at the police station in Valiant, Oklahoma. We don't have any evidence to show that he was under arrest at that time, but he was questioned by this law enforcement officer, and it soon turned accusatory. The law enforcement officer said, "I don't believe you. I think you're lying." And at that point, Mr. Meek said, "Well, I want to talk to a lawyer. I think I should get the advice of counsel." Now, the jury hearing that will obviously punish the accused person for lawyering up.
No, it's not obvious at all. But beyond that, let me ask you this. Assuming for the moment, and I still need to be, I think, further convinced on this, but assuming for the moment that we're under de novo review on this issue, okay? Is there any Supreme Court precedent, anything that would have required the OCCA to view that as touching on his right to counsel? I mean, as having a Fifth Amendment dimension. I didn't see anything cited in your brief in the direct appeal, and I don't see anything cited in your opening brief that indicates that there would have been any controlling authority that required the OCCA to rule in your favor.
Yes, I did cite Farley v. State from the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals saying that pre-arrest silence isn't even relevant to anything. A person can have multiple reasons for refusing to speak to the police. And Mr. Meek went one step further. He not only said nothing, he actively invoked his right to counsel.
And this well, relevancy decision is not a Fifth Amendment. It's my understanding, maybe I'm wrong, but correct me. It's my understanding that you're talking about this implicating his Fifth Amendment rights. Am I right on that?
Correct.
Well, then what does Farley say about that? Anything?
No, that was one court case showing that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to object to it. Another case would be this court's decision in United States v. Burson, which was a tax evasion case where IRS agents go and knock on the door and the guy just doesn't want to talk to them. This court found that was reversible error. And again, Mr. Meek did more than that. He said, I'm not only going to remain silent, I want to speak to a lawyer. And that was used to show that he's guilty of this crime.
Our case was, he was reversible error for what reason? Was it of,
because it was an improper prosecutorial comment on the right to the accused invocation of his right to counsel.
Okay. Well, the OCCA didn't have to follow our cases. So the question would be, what is it, even if we're not under EPTA deference, what if there is, are you saying that it would there we would need to rely on what we had determined in this context in determining whether the OCCA was right or wrong?
I'm out of time, Your Honor. May I answer?
Please answer.
The legal analysis is whether trial counsel rendered deficient performance. Can you really read that transcript and say that a reasonably proficient defense counsel would sit there and listen to that testimony and not object to it? Because he has authority from this circuit, authority in Griffin v. California from the Supreme Court, which is the general proposition that it is unconstitutional to punish the accused person in a criminal case for invoking his constitutional rights. And did that prejudice the petitioner here? That's my answer, Your Honor. And I could see I'm out of time.
Well, this is an important case, and I've monopolized the time. So if my colleagues have something to talk about now, we can do that. And then we can give Mr. Hankins some rebuttal when necessary.
Well, could I just ask, we haven't touched on the sufficiency of the evidence. I have a couple of questions about that. One of the sufficiency issues concerns the evidence of Mr. Meek purchasing the plastic containers at Walmart and whether that would permit an inference of planning for purposes of showing malice aforethought. Why wouldn't that be a reasonable inference for the jury to make, especially when we're dealing here with a double deference review under AEDPA?
Well, that's the inference that the state would like to make. And in our view, Yara, that's just, those are common household things. It's too attenuated to connect a Walmart purchase to actual murder. And that kind of inquiry has to be framed in terms of the accusation framed by the state that Jerry Meek killed Hope Meek and inflicted mortal wounds on her body. Where's the state's evidence of that?
Well,
that's the crux.
Well, I'm going to the malice aforethought element. I know you've got arguments on the other elements of first degree murder, but assuming the evidence was sufficient on the other elements, I'm interested in this particular piece of evidence. What does the evidence show as to whether this purchase was done before or after she may have been killed?
My recollection is it showed it was done before.
Based on what? What was the evidence to show that?
My recollection is that they were able to show that the time, basically a time frame of the Walmart purchase.
I've been going through the record on this, and that's why I'm asking you the question. I'll ask the state the same one. Before we leave this, why wasn't the evidence of motive sufficient to show malice aforethought?
Well, because it was counteracted by even more powerful evidence of the motive of Hope Meek to abandon her family. She was unhappy there. She only stayed there because she got pregnant. And then there was testimony of her bizarre behavior concerning her children. Total disinterest in them. Regina Meek's testimony of, remember the bizarre behavior where Regina shows up, the air conditioner's blasting, Hope is standing there smoking in the doorway with the door open, the baby's crying. And she's totally unaffected by it. Regina changes the diaper, hands her the baby, and Hope says, disinterestedly, just put it back where you found it. I mean, there are several instances like that showing that it was actually Hope who was in a situation she did not want to be in.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Hankins. We'll hear from the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Randall Yates on behalf of Respondent Jimmy Martin. May it please the court. So I'd like to first discuss the ineffective assistance counsel issue and then take up sufficiency of the evidence and accumulation after that. Your Honor, under Harrington v. Richter, it is difficult to establish ineffective assistance when counsel's overall performance indicates active and capable advocacy. And the record here reveals a vigorous adversarial trial with hundreds of objections by Mr. Meek's counsel before and during trial, poignant cross-examination of every one of the state's witnesses, a full defense in which he called 26 witnesses, including an expert. He had several sidebars with the court to advance Mr. Meek's cause, and he gave a thorough closing argument. Here, it simply cannot be said that Meek's counsel was not functioning as counsel. And right now, I'd just like to point out some of the tension between the arguments for sufficiency of evidence and ineffective assistance of counsel. I'm quoting counsel right now that said that all evidence the state put on was, quote, put on by more powerful evidence by the defense. So on one hand, he's claiming that he was not behaving as counsel. And on the other hand, he's claiming that counsel was so good that they should have believed counsel's version of the events. So with the...
Would good counsel have handled the goodbye note the way this counsel did? I mean, how is that defensible?
Well, Your Honor, as far as with the assistance of counsel claim, when it comes to the goodbye note, that is going to be reviewed under the double deference standard of AEDPA.
Well, I'm looking, I got that, but I'm looking real hard, even under that lens, to find out why this is defensible. Why is it defensible for him to sit on it, not give it up during discovery, and in a situation in which he had had it wait until after the state's case was closed in order to all of a sudden present this, and then did not, and it's my understanding the major issue here is, then did not make a proffer such that it was in evidence when it was on direct appeal. I mean, how many competent counsel do you know who do that?
Well, Your Honor, I think we have to go back to the record and we have to look at, you know, what the trial court found. And the trial court found that it was strategic, that it wasn't accidental, and that it was, you know, for the purpose of getting in something that, you know, maybe he never had control of. And the judge below, you know, made that finding in the nicest of ways, but he did find it to be strategic.
Well, strategic could go towards why he arguably tried to sandbag the state by waiting until after their case closed. But what's the strategic? And I didn't understand, and correct me on this, I did not understand the trial judge's strategic comment to go to the subsequent act. The subsequent act is get it in the record so that it will be there for a direct appeal. What strategic reason could you have for doing that? And I didn't see anything that the trial court said about that issue.
Yeah, you're correct on that issue. The trial court was limited to strategic in the sense of sandbagging the state, like you said, Your Honor. I'd like to point out that the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals decision was based solely on the prejudice prong. And I think even under the strong presumptions that everything is reviewed on the merits, I think in this case, if you look at the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals decision, ultimately they made very clear that they were just looking at the prejudice prong and reviewed it under that. So if we're looking at the prejudice prong under the double deference that we're given under both Strickland and AEDPA, you know, it's whether any fair-minded jurist could disagree on the correctness of the state's court's decision. So, I mean, I think that here, a fair-minded jurist could easily conclude that there was just not a high enough probability that turning over the note before trial, assuming it existed, would have changed the outcome of the case.
Okay. So you're saying that, well, there are two issues of prejudice here. One is the issue of putting it in, well, there are two acts here. One relates to the actual failure to include it in the record. So the Court of Criminal Appeals says, okay, initially, and correct me if you have a different view of this. My understanding was the court said, okay, you've waived this because you didn't proffer it. You didn't put it in. Even if you had put it in, it would not have had a material effect on the verdict. It wouldn't have been prejudicial under Strickland. Therefore, it's not prejudicial. Is that your understanding of what happened?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So you're saying that under the double deference that they're accorded on that prejudice ruling, that there's no way that this would have there's no reasonable probability that this would have affected the outcome.
Or it's fair-minded jurists could find that there's not enough high enough.
This would have had
effect on the outcome. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, okay. Let me ask you point blank, because I thought your brief was somewhat equivocal on this point. Do you agree with the district court that the OCCA did not rule on the merits of the ineffective assistance as it relates to the invocation of the right to counsel?
Okay. I'm sorry. I was, my listening was on the goodbye note.
Okay. Let me take a step back on the invocation of the right to counsel. The argument being made that implicated his right to Fifth Amendment right to be silent. I was trying to make sense of what your brief was saying on that issue, and it wasn't clear to me whether you agree or whether you just didn't want to fight about it. I mean, do you agree with the district court that issue was not ruled on the merits by the OCCA?
Ultimately, I'm going to agree, Your Honor. I think if you go back and you look at some of our briefing below, ultimately we do make that claim that they didn't look at that. I think in the first instance, it should have been barred under independent and adequate state law, and that it wasn't properly raised. I think that was a good
briefing
claim.
Briefing below, as in your briefing before the OCCA, you agree? Well, I mean, briefing where? To the district court?
To the district court, Your Honor.
That they didn't agree with it. Well, and the district court followed suit. Well, ultimately, what is the effect of that statement? I mean, if I read the record differently, that the OCCA did rule on the merits, why wouldn't their statement in their petition in response to the petition for rehearing, why isn't that saying we've been there, we've done that, we considered it, and we rejected it? Why isn't that a valid reading of that order?
I think that it is a valid reading of that order, and your point is well taken, Your Honor. I had gone into this case, not fighting on that issue particularly. Okay. I do understand where the court is coming from.
Okay, and I guess the point I would make on, and I don't want to press this too hard, but on the effect of your decision to agree with the district court, I know in the context of exhaustion, if you expressly say we agree this has been exhausted, I mean, EPA would essentially have us go along with that view. In this context, do we have the discretion to say, well, we read it differently? That's not what the OCCA said.
I don't have a cite for you, but this is in a different context, and you may have such authority, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, please. I don't want to occupy.
Okay. If I could, just a moment, take up the right to remain silent. I think that even under Strickland, this could be reasonable trial strategy not to object. The same evidence, the request for a lawyer, had already gotten in from a transcript from a 2003 custody hearing, and it was read into the record, and it was done so over counsel's objection. So another objection at that point isn't going to cure anything. And furthermore, the question itself, the question was essentially, how did the interview end? That was unobjectionable. So the jury would have already had to hear the answer before defense counsel could lob any objection and ask for a curative instruction. It certainly wasn't enough for a mistrial. And, you know, when the best you can do is a curative instruction for something that the jury had already heard, it's just a matter of trial strategy, whether to lob an objection at that point or not.
Okay. Well, then, since this looks, the premise of where we're going now is we're under de novo review, we would have to determine, as a court would have to determine it was trial strategy. But let's shift the lens for a second here to prejudice. Well, no, let me ask you on this ineffective assistance, on the representation prong for a second. Is there any law? Do we have a case that would require us to find that the court, that counsel should have objected? In other words, is there a law that would have said the OCCA was wrong to find that the underlying issue implicated the Fifth Amendment? In other words, let me frame it this way. Is the underlying issue here of his invocation of the right to counsel, do we have any precedent that says that implicates his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent?
No, Your Honor, and I'm not sure that it does, because what he was commenting on was not pre-silence arrest. I think, you know, what he was commenting on is what happened during a voluntary statement.
But I understood petitioner's argument to be that by including that information, just like they cited, I guess it was Griffin, that what the impact of this was to implicate his right to remain silent. And so that leads me to say that if we're under de novo review, and we're trying to determine whether there was some legal error here that a reasonably competent counsel would have objected to, do you have any authority that suggests that was legal error?
I don't have any authority to say that was legal error, Your Honor. You know, in fact, I would argue that it wasn't, because if we're following the logic of Griffin and then followed up with the Jenkins case, I think that the terms they use, you know, and this is in the context of a witness or a defendant taking the stand in their own defense, the words they use is shedding the cloak of silence, and then those things to be able to be used by the prosecution. So here I think that Mr. Meek shed his cloak of silence in a number of different ways. You know, he's the one that reported Ms. Meek missing. He filled out a statement unsolicited to law enforcement that had his defense in it. He came in for a voluntary, agreed upon, all-time free leave non-custodial interview and went out. And as soon as he got some pushback, which I think is analogous to impeachment, just we're outside of the trial context, that he had already shed his cloak of silence and that it was therefore not any sort of error to begin with.
Speaking of pushback, let me push back on your impeachment argument. How in the world is that impeachment? I mean, that argument was made in your brief. It's made, I believe, by the district court. He's on direct examination offering testimony. How's that impeachment of Mr. Meek? I mean, that's not any rules of evidence I know of as to how that turns out to be impeachment. How's that impeachment?
I think you're correct, Your Honor, and I'm happy to walk that one back. But I think it's analogous to the logic followed in Jenkins when they said that impeachment evidence could get in. This is just the same sort of thing, just in a different context. One is pre-arrest, one is during trial, and you know, and in fact, we know from a case called Salina v. Texas that you know your right during trial is even stronger than it is pre-arrest. And if I could just before we leave that, come up with the prejudice prong is that, you know, and this is where sort of prejudice and performance kind of bleed together, and that it ultimately, if we're looking at this under Strickland, it's evidence that's not going to matter that much. And so if we look at the factors that used in Borson, where you found, you know, similar statements to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The factors you looked at were how the prosecutor used that evidence. And here it wasn't to advance the case at all. There was no probative value. It was just part of a larger story of Agent Fielding's investigation. It wasn't used in prosecution's opening or closing, made no further comment on it whatsoever. And in fact, in this case, defendant did take the stand. They didn't go back and use it. And so, and that cuts two ways as well, as that they didn't use it there on prejudice, but then also on prejudice again, this was evidence that would have ultimately been admissible in trial.
And as you said, at the, I think relative to the hearing, he had, there was a time when he had previously invoked his right to counsel, essentially, right? Didn't your brief say there was evidence that happened too?
There was testimony that he had requested a lawyer. Yes.
Okay. Anything from my colleagues?
Yes, I would like to ask a question. Under Oklahoma law, and particularly I believe it's the Arnold case, they say the only admissible evidence regarding intent is circumstantial. The state's evidence exclude every reasonable hypothesis except that of malice aforethought. How do you do that in this case?
Well, I think we did it how the court did it. You showed all the reasons that Mr. Meek had to commit this murder. You showed that he stood the most to gain from her complete and total disappearance in ways that, you know, just asking for a divorce wouldn't have. You know, she was a drain on him financially. She was ruining her life and threatened to take the kids. And that's all evidence that can go towards malice aforethought, Your Honor.
Well, but is it? It has to point to all. In other words, did you answer every issue that they raised? Because malice aforethought is still part of one of the four that you've got to show. And did you exclude every issue that he raised in regards to why he was innocent?
Yes, Your Honor. There was back and forth. If you go back and look at the trial transcript, there was back and forth on every single issue in there. And this is something that the jury weighed and came out with and found him guilty. And under the Jackson standard, the double deference of AEDPA, that was not unreasonable.
Okay. Well, I have a related question. How could the jury meaningfully address malice aforethought and come to a conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt when there was no evidence at all about the method or manner of death?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that's just something that is secondary to the fact that there wasn't a body recovered in this case. And
well, I don't know about secondary. It seems like it just goes along with the fact that there was no body recovered, but we don't know how she died. I mean, how do we know that they weren't fighting and he pushed her and she fell and hit her head?
Well, the first reason is because defendant himself denies that that's what took place. So even under, you know, defendant's versions of the fact, that's not something that happened.
Well, the defendant's version is that she disappeared, but your version is that he killed her, but you have no evidence to show how she was killed.
Well, we know that the last place she was seen alive was in the upstairs master bedroom. We know that he, as soon as she disappeared, removed carpet from the upstairs master bedroom and had it replaced and did no other upgrades to the house. And we know that he...
Counsel, none of this goes to how she was killed. Did he hit her? Did he shoot her? Did he stab her? Did he choke her? Did she fall and accidentally hit her head? All of this would be relevant to malice aforethought, but that's an empty, that's just an empty canvas as far as the evidence goes. And the carpet, removal of the carpet comes afterwards. That doesn't go to malice aforethought.
Well, it's the same way that the court below addressed it, Your Honor. It was, you can make circumstantial inferences based on the situation that he was facing and the fact that he had so much to gain from her complete and total disappearance from
his
perspective.
All right. So, counsel, you're still not, I understand that your argument seems to be based on motive evidence. And I get that. But I'm asking you, with the absence of any evidence about how she was killed, how does that, along the lines of Judge Baldock's question, exclude various possibilities that they were fighting? How do we know it's not just a heat of passion situation?
Well, these were things,
and not a premeditation situation.
Yes. Well, these were things that the jury considered. The jury was
given the evidence, what was the evidence of malice aforethought other than motive? Let me ask you a more specific question. Under the evidence as the state understood it and presented it, when exactly was she killed on the timeline? Where would you have put the time of the killing? Was it before or after he went to Walmart, for example, on February 21st? What does the evidence show?
The evidence would put it into a time frame that appears to suggest it was that she was dead before that.
And what do you base that on?
I think that I base that partly on the argument. The time frame, could have been wider, because I mean, here's what we know is that, if what the jury found there was that, he did murder her, is that he's the only one there when it happens, and that it's a house with him and her there for several hours.
Well, that may get you to manslaughter, but how do we get to first degree murder based on premeditation? If he killed her before he went to Walmart, the purchase of the containers comes after the fact. And to the extent it's probative of malice aforethought, it's pretty weak at that point, because it doesn't evidence pre-planning, does it?
It may, Your Honor. It may, Your Honor, in that he bought them in an effort to dispose of her body. And if it, happened before he did, then that would go to that sort of evidence, Your Honor.
After he killed her in the heat of passion, he bought the totes. That doesn't say anything about a malice aforethought. I thought the evidence was that he saw her, then went to Walmart. And when he saw her, he was alive. So I'm surprised by your answer. I mean, what are you pointing to say that it had, that she was dead before he went to Walmart? Because it's my understanding that he saw her, she was alive, they didn't speak, he went to Walmart, and he came back and got the kids. Isn't that what he said?
No, you're correct. You're correct, Your Honor. And the timeline, what we have, because it's just Mr. Meek and Miss Meek there, is that, we don't know which one it is, before or after.
It would be in his interest to give us the best story in his own interest. And his testimony would be that she was alive, right?
It was his testimony that she was alive, Your Honor.
Well, the jury can't really rely on his testimony for time of death, because his testimony is that she's alive.
And again, Your Honor, these are all things that the jury considered when they went there. And if we're looking at it, the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals looking at it under the Jackson case, you make all inferences in favor of the state, and you find if any rational trier of fact come up to that. And malice aforethought, premeditation is not. It doesn't take a long time to establish those things. It could have been made that morning. And so then when you put the added layer of deference of AEDPA, I think a fair-minded jurist could say that a rational trier of fact in the light most or in the evidence most favorable to the state could reach that conclusion, Your Honor.
Okay, absent any other questions, I thought I had given you a lot of time, Mr. Hankins. Apparently, we are not. Nevertheless, we got to be respectful of the other counsel on this argument. But That said, you have 2.5 minutes if you want to in rebuttal.
I would just leave the court with this. Jerry Meek went to the police. He made a statement before trial. That's a state's exhibit number 5. And what he said was, Hope Meek, they had a fight. She threatened to leave and start a new life. He thought she would cool down and come back, and she never did. He testified basically to that defense at trial. And this goes to show the prejudice of the goodbye note. He actually had a method to show that his testimony was true. And only by counsel's, failing to follow basically discovery rules, was he not able to do that. So to me, that seems to be by far the most prejudicial evidentiary item that we present. And with that, I have no more.
All right. Case is submitted. Thank you, counsel, for the good arguments. I appreciate it.